This episode was recorded on the traditional lands of the Gadigal and Mongol people of the Eora Nation and the Darug people of the Darug Nation.
We acknowledge that sovereignty of these lands was never ceded and pay our respects to elders past and present.
Welcome to A Clash of Critics, your scholarly podcast about George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
She's Mia, I'm Scott, and today we're looking at Chapter 21, Tyrion 3 of A Game of Thrones.
Here's the chapter summary according to a wiki of Ice and Fire. Tyrion dines with the high officers of the Night's Watch and promises Lord Commander Mormont that he will speak to the king of their need. Afterwards, while paying a final visit to the Wall, Tyrion meets Jon Snow, who asks Tyrion to do what he can to help his brother Bran.
Okay, so this episode is centered on the type of tourism exhibited by Tyrion Lannister, both in this chapter but also in previous chapters as well. It's not quite dark tourism, I don't think, or even voluntourism, although it does highlight aspects of it, but it is certainly a tourism of a kind that is sadly often experienced by places and people enduring long-term suffering. And I think the closest phenomena is perhaps slum tourism, although there are some key divergences as well. But this is what we are going to explore in today's episode. That said, Tyrion, even though we're exploring this through the lens of slum tourism, Tyrion is also at the Wall primarily to see what amounts to a historic landmark or a heritage site for Westeros. In the show, he does describe it as one of the great architectural wonders of the known world. So it is also rather conventional of tourism. So we're going to explore what it means to label it slum tourism and what that does for our reading of this point of view. Today, primarily, we'll be referring to Malt Steinbrick, Fabian Frenzel, and Co. Cohen's slum tourism, Poverty, Power, and Ethics. And there is a phrase in the introduction of that book that I particularly like, which goes, quote, "Every new trend in tourism allows wider reflections on tourism itself," end quote. So even if we don't quite land on Tyrion being an enterprising slum tourist per se, it does invite some interesting reflections on the practice of tourism, as we will see. So Tyrion does not set out with any interest in the Night's Watch himself. He's solely interested in the Wall as an architectural wonder. In Tyrion 1, the Wall, in quotation marks, is his focus when he announces to his family that he will be going. He barely even mentions who actually lives there. And we also get a strong sense of dismissiveness towards the Night's Watch itself in his exchange with his brother Jaime. Quite bluntly says the only thing worth doing there is to see the Wall and, quote, piss off the edge of the world, end quote. And we can glean from the frustration of the sour watchman at Tyrion's late night touristic impulse to climb the Wall one last time how well this kind of attitude might be received. This does set him aside somewhat from the motives of slum tourism itself, which can often vary between an attitude of charity to more problematically indulging in pleasure, but we'll get more into that later. We might draw parallels between Tyrion's interests in the Wall and those who visit World Heritage sites while ignoring the plights of the local people. I'm thinking specifically of people who travel to Palmyra in Syria, or Nimrud or Mosul in Iraq, or perhaps even visiting Bethlehem or Old Jerusalem in occupied Palestine, the pyramids in Egypt, so forth. We might even draw a parallel between the vulgarity of Tyrion's phrase and the vulgarity displayed by tourists when they were allowed to walk all over Uluru in central Australia, in some cases literally pissing and shitting on what is actually a sacred site for the local Aboriginal people. This actually ties into Orientalism in a way, as some of its more dominant archetypes and knowledge tropes formed about the Middle East were formed by European travellers who were either completely uninterested in the present-day realities of places like Egypt, or regarded those present-day realities as profoundly disappointing in the shadow of the historic greatness of the Egyptian empires and so forth.
Yeah, I think what makes tourism such a kind of apt word for thinking about Tyrion in Song of Ice and Fire, because obviously when you think about Song of Ice and Fire or any fantasy series, you don't necessarily think of tourism as like an industry that's operating in this particular world, but I think the two kind of fundamental aspects to tourism that absolutely apply to, if not the kind of conscious attitudes, certainly the underlying values had by people like Tyrion, is one, the idea that you can commodify an experience and that you can acquire an authentic experience if you have the resources to do so. And also the idea that visiting these places is a temporary thing. It's the idea is always to leave. And the reason I want to bring this up is because we're going to talk a little bit more about Dany in future chapters. And there are some things that we'll discuss with Dany, but tourism doesn't quite apply to her because there isn't the assumption that she is definitely going to leave this particular situation. It's more complicated than that. we'll unpack the complexity. But tourism specifically implies a temporality of the visit that is inherent in Tyrion's trip to the Wall.
Okay, so slum tourism has several defining features. It has evolved into significant industries, especially in nations we would consider the global south. It tends to be guided tours, or I like to say guarded tours, particularly drawing a connection with Tyrion and his Lannister henchmen. It jars with common sense notions of holidaying, so we do get a hint of that in the reactions by Tyrion's siblings, Cersei and Jaime. But the main characteristic is this thing, this phenomena called slumming, which is defined as, quote, the touristic valorization of poverty-stricken urban areas of the metropolises in so-called developing or emerging nations, which are visited primarily by tourists from the global north, end quote. Now, Castle Black is neither a metropolis nor urban, although I do think we can potentially read castles as urban-adjacent spaces, maybe. They're certainly built up in a way, have population density. There's a parallel there, if not being able to actually describe it as urban itself. But I think we can certainly read Castle Black as poverty-stricken in terms of its general state of disrepair, as well as its predominant association with the lower classes in contemporary Westeros. I mean, Tyrion does note the ominous lean of Harden's Tower and jokes about arresting stonemasons in Jon 3. I mean, we're going to talk about how Tyrion feels he can't actually help. One thing he could probably do is pay some stonemasons to go work at Castle Black for a time. They don't need to be arrested, Tyrion. And then we get the description in this chapter of, quote, windowless keeps, crumbling walls, courtyards choked with broken stone, end quote. So I do think we can describe this as a poor place or a poverty-stricken place, even though a lot of the contemporary understanding of slum tourism doesn't quite match. I would argue that Tyrion's actions reflect early slumming practices, particularly in Victorian England, than the more globalized phenomenon that I just defined. And this is how Steinbrück, Frenzo, and Cohen explain that historical context. So, quote, curiosity about slums appears to be as old as the slum itself. The term slum evolved in 18th century London. Originally, slum was a slang word, presumably of Irish origin, coined by slum dwellers. It only found its way into standard English around 1840 and was then used by upper-class Londoners to describe the East End. During the same period, the word slumming evolved in London's West Side lingo. The term described a burgeoning practice of members of London's higher classes visiting the East End, often guided by police officers in civilian attire, journalists, and clergymen. Again, we can draw a connection here with Tyrion and his Lannister guards, as well as hanging out predominantly with the High Command. These early slummers were frequently wrapped in the cloak of concern, welfare, and charity. However, this changed in the second half of the 19th century when slumming developed into a more purpose-free leisure time activity. End quote. And then they continue, quote, the historic cases of slumming in London and the United States are quite well documented. These studies also point to continuities in the development of slum tourism, for example, in the way that tourists gaze on slums seeking the low, the dark, the, quote, unknown side of the city, end quote. The examples demonstrate that the slum was discursively construed as well as touristically staged and experienced as the other side of the city and as the place of the other. At the same time, they illustrate that this ascribed other had often been a lot more than just the economic other. The slum was more than just the place of poverty. The slum was also a surface for the projection of a societal other. Dominant modes of social distinction were negotiated through the topography of urban landscapes. However, these dominant modes and characteristics of the other varied from one historical period to another and depended on their respective social context. So they go on to describe how in Victorian London, slums were seen as places of moral decay or libidinal liberty, the place of the immoral other. And I think we can definitely see some resonances here between Tyrion's indulgences and these constructions of the slum or slumming, or rather connections between what Steinbrück, Frenzel and Coens describe and how certain characters like Tywin and Cersei perceive Tyrion's activities and not just at the wall. So Mia, what do you think about Tyrion's relationship to slumming? And again, not just the slumming that he engages in at the wall. And how might his own experiences of being othered factor in here?
Yeah, I think Tyrion's experiences of being othered are quite fundamental to how we can understand his relationship to slumming, much like how his experiences of othered, I think, always a part of how he kind of approaches the world, essentially, and how he understands the world around him. So we've discussed before, and we will discuss again, the fact that Tyrion, like Jon, is someone who will frequently use his experience, his very real experiences of oppression, to align himself with others who have very different experiences to him. So I think that Tyrion sees himself as someone whose perceptiveness, and we've discussed the extent to which he actually is perceptive before, but he obviously thinks of himself as someone who's very perceptive. So I think he sees himself as someone who is perceptive both because of his upbringing and education and his experiences of being othered in society. And I think there is definitely truth to this, but there is this assumption, well, I believe there is an assumption, that Tyrion could come to understand the conditions of the wall through limited physical proximity and conversations primarily with the most privileged people at the wall. And I don't think that he would extend that same kind of access to knowledge to other people. So I don't think that Tyrion, for example, would think that a peasant could come and spend a bit of time in the Red Keep and then just understand Tyrion's experiences of life through that. So I think there's this kind of way that Tyrion sees his own access to particular forms of knowledge as being both the product of his education and the product of him being someone who has been marginalized. Yeah, I want to be kind of careful because I don't think that's entirely like just flat out wrong, but I think he extends his ability to relate to others in ways that are just not a reality. And the series will continually critique that as we move into further books. At the same time in this chapter, Tyrion also uses his otherness to reinforce the idea that he doesn't belong at the wall. So I find this an interesting line that is straddling throughout this chapter. So Tyrion does like to align himself with bastards, who very much have a place at the wall, but he's very quick to make jokes suggesting that people with dwarfism would be comical at the wall, just they don't have a place there. And that's in a very specific point after Mormont very explicitly says, we need more people like you. And he's talking about, you know, Tyrion as someone who is very intelligent and cunning, I think is the actual word that's used. But Tyrion mocks this idea. And he does this by bringing a focus back onto his body and saying, well, I'll go and find all the dwarves in the Seven Kingdoms and bring them to you. Now, we can see in other parts of the series that these jokes about Tyrion's body, they're very strategic. And sometimes they're done really well in ways that are very enjoyable. In this context, Tyrion's actually kind of reinforcing a barrier between himself and those at the wall in a way to kind of shield himself from any potential feeling that he might be able to stick around and actually help people there. So he's using this lack of belonging as a form of protection, because Tyrion's excited to see the wall, but specifically he plans to see it once. He says he's not going to return. He doesn't believe he's ever going to return. And he doesn't want to relinquish the kind of luxurious life that he has normally. This is very much a temporary situation for him. And I think he uses that otherness to reinforce that boundary, to feel like he doesn't have an obligation to ever come back.
Yeah, he's very much of the opinion, don't give my dad any ideas.
Yep.
Yeah, his indulgences in slumming is going to be interesting to unpack further, because we do have his relationship with Bronn over the next couple of books as well, which is very different to what he's doing here at the war. Bronn is not highborn. He's a very different person to the individuals who are part of the Night's Watch's current high command. And then, of course, his proclivity to visit brothels is also a very strong aspect of his character. We have him mention in his exchange with Jamie, how the sex workers of the realm will go begging if he takes the black. So again, there are aspects to his slumming that definitely resonate with the way in which, I guess, historic slumming was conceived of, or at least traced by the theorists we're focusing on today. So Tyrion navigates several appeals to provide aid in this chapter. He even reflects to himself that people seem to be asking a great deal of him today. And I would question whether it actually is a great deal, what's being asked of him.
Poor Tyrion.
just have a word to people is not actually a great deal. You know, GM Mormont attempts numerous different strategies to secure material and meaningful aid for the institution, while Jon Snow, of course, also requests Tyrion's goodwill. Both in terms of just passing on a message, again, just asking to pass on a word, Tyrion, but also something more meaningful for Bran. And we do see that Tyrion takes this request seriously in his next chapter, I believe. Mormont attempts flattery, and Aemon is much more successful at flattering Tyrion. And then he attempts reverse psychology, setting up Alyssa Thorne as potentially being right to kind of shame Tyrion to being more meaningful with his aid. And then he becomes way more direct when alone. Attempts to set up indebtedness with the guarded escort back to Winterfell. Emphasizes the Night's Watch's defensive insufficiencies, which Tyrion responds simply by correcting the math and then yawns, which I want to slap him for. We also witness Tyrion's mental gymnastics in dismissing or nullifying forms of local knowledge. He's embarrassed in the face of Jeor's earnestness and believes it has more to do with Mormont's personal legacy than need. He counters the implied Long Night warning with a jape about the Great Summer. I mean, the Long Night is literally why the Night's Watch and the Wall exists. So there's a stark difference between that sort of story and the kind that he's referencing with the Great Summer. He stresses the phrase in your dreams as Mormont warns of darker things. And then he more out of hand dismisses the testimony of Fisher Folk, which is both a disregard of local knowledge as well as lower class knowledge. So Mia, what did you notice about Tyrion in this chapter as he navigates these various appeals for help?
Yeah, Tyrion does eventually commit to providing some help, but it's very superficial. As you noted, Tyrion is someone who has the ability to actually make meaningful change at the Wall, potentially. And Mormont says this very clearly. After Tyrion makes a very vague comment saying he hopes he can repay Mormont's kindness, Mormont explicitly points out that he can. So he says, quote, "Your sister sits beside the king. Your brother is a great knight, and your father is the most powerful lord in the Seven Kingdoms. Speak to them for us. Tell them of our need here. The Night's Watch is dying." When Tyrion does eventually promise to talk to his incredibly powerful family, he immediately has this kind of mental caveat where he's like, well, technically, I will do that. I am as good as my word. I will have a word to them, but it's not going to do anything. And I didn't, you know, essentially saying, I didn't promise I'd actually help. I promised I would have a word with my family, and that's what I will do. Now, I do want to be careful here because I don't want to suggest that Tyrion should be engaging in a different kind of tourism, one that you mentioned in the introduction, voluntourism, which is where wealthy people go to another country to help in a way that they have decided will do good, while also providing themselves with this, quote, authentic experience. Hopefully they can get some nice Instagram pictures or photos for their Tinder profile in the process. So we're not saying that Tyrion should go to the Wall and tell them all, this is how I'm going to fix your life. Here, Mormont is actually explaining the ways that Tyrion can help. He's saying, this is the way that you can materially help us. And Tyrion's very dismissive of this, especially like in his own kind of mind. And I think it's quite easy reading this to go along with Tyrion's justification, you know. Robert won't listen to him. He won't be able to actually do any good. Like, he'll do what he can, but he's very limited. I think the issue that Tyrion has is he's only thinking about ways of helping that map onto these existing structures that have clearly led to the situation they're in the first place. So you mentioned before, Scott, like, he can just pay a stonemason. You don't have to arrest a stonemason in order for them to help. You can pay someone, they can go do some labor, go home. But by thinking within these existing structures and thinking, oh, you know, we have to do things the way it's always been done, Tyrion essentially has a way to kind of get out of doing any of the hard work that he's being called to do. I also want to point out here the frustration that Tyrion experiences throughout this chapter at everyone you know, everyone's asking him for help. It's such an imposition on Tyrion. And that's clearly coming from this disconnect between what he thought this trip would be. And it is a trip, as you say, like there's this one thing he wants to do. He wants to see these sights. And I think if we were to compare it to our world, it might be someone like who can say that they've been to Antarctica, because not many people can say that. So they can say that they've done that. So he wants to go and then maybe provide some superficial support so he can feel good about himself and then leave. But the reality is he's been asked to do actual things that are not super difficult, but maybe if he wants to actually help, would require him to go outside of his comfort zone a little bit, actually have real conversations with people, actually think about ways that he can provide resources that are maybe not the typical resources that would be provided to the wall. And yeah, I think being asked to step outside of his holiday up north is, yeah, I think that's where his frustration is coming from.
It's interesting to think about why Winterfell doesn't provide the stonemasons as well. It's not just an issue limited to Tyrion. And Ned recognizes the growing threat of the wildlings across the wall, so there, I guess, is more, even more imperative for the North to financially aid the Night's Watch in reconstructing itself and its defenses. So it's not just limited to Tyrion, it's a critique of the particular way a lot of people in power tend to think about how they can help the Night's Watch. It's just dumping our criminals on them to man the wall. Like, evidently, even that connection between Ned and his brother at the war has not really led to any sort of material benefit either. And it's interesting how Mormont doesn't even mention the wildlings to Tyrion. He mentions the wildlings are fleeing from something, but he doesn't emphasize the threat of the king beyond the war, because that doesn't matter to Tyrion. That is a northern problem. So again, tying back to our previous episode about ideology and how wildlings are emphasized in particular parts of Westeros, the Vale, the North, we see evidence here of that being recognized as not a persuasive reason to send help to the war from those further south of the Neck, besides the Vale. And it is also worth pointing out that Tyrion is the Hand of the King in the next book, and he doesn't even use that power, really, to help the Night's Watch. He can't escape the pettiness when it comes to it being the messenger, Alistair Thorne. So again, he doesn't reflect on his thoughts here once he has more of a position to help later on in the series as well. But like you said, I think Tyrion's demeanor here, his irritation, his embarrassment, sarcasm, highlights how he envisioned this trip purely in touristic terms. And it definitely has that feel of locals exploiting his holiday. But you know, Mormont's earnestness also kind of reminds me of experiences that I had while in occupied Palestine doing ethnographic fieldwork. And this fieldwork piggybacked activist and witnessing tours around Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. So as there, I'm not even sure what kind of tourism you'd call that. Maybe it is a bit closer to volunteerism, but I'm certainly not wealthy going there trying to fix things. So again, it's this different thing. But it was ostensibly about witnessing the conditions of military occupation and talking to Palestinians. Palestinians were quite eager to share their stories and to highlight these conditions. But I did encounter a lot of fatigue with foreign NGOs, and have since heard about it even more after the fact. Fatigue with foreign NGOs and activist tours and researchers witnessing Palestinian suffering, because these often lack any sort of commitment to political projects back home intended to genuinely help alleviate or address these unjust conditions. Empty words, kind of like Tyrion acknowledges that his are here. So that's what I always think about when I think about Tyrion at the wall. And, you know, I imagine that this fatigue is also not specific to Palestinians, but is felt much more broadly across colonized and oppressed and suffering peoples who find themselves the subject matter of the global slum tourism industry. That's it for this chapter. We'll be back soon for chapter 22, Arya 2.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider pledging to our Patreon at patreon.com/tropewatchers. Pledges start at $1 a month and help with our ongoing running costs.
If you don't have cash to spare, you can also support us by rating us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice.
Or send us to a friend who you think would enjoy the podcast.
If you're a fan of the Clash of Critics, be sure to tune into our flagship podcast, Trope Watchers, the podcast about pop culture and why it matters.
Our website is tropewatchers.com/aclashofcritics. We are on social media at aclashofcritics, and you can email us at aclashofcritics@gmail.com.
See you next time.